So the next up is Kanek Pena Vargas. He's a member of Estación Libre and Visual Resistance. Kanek is currently working on translating and editing a series of Zapatista communiques that are going to come out in book form next year.
Yeah. Not translating, but editing. Yeah, it sounds like okay, so like Calamity, I'm not a big public speaker. I usually feel more comfortable at home making banners and posters by myself, expressing myself like that. But I'll do my best because I wanted to help out and I was told that I could help out by speaking. So I'll try to offer some words that are useful and might be good to spark discussion. So I was going to talk a little bit about some early Zapatismo stuff, try to contextualize the Sixth Declaration, talk a little bit about the other campaign, and try to talk a little bit about solidarity from over here. Like we could gather from Renee's presentation, Zapatismo has a really, really long history. But the kind of Zapatismo that we think about usually these days, or folks who call Neo-Zapatismo, started to take form as far as like an organization in like 1983, 1984, in the form of the EZLN, Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, Zapatista Army for National Liberation. And, you know, was a long, almost decade-long process of methodical organizing silently in the mountains region of Chiapas. And it wasn't until 1994 that there was an uprising and occupation and a taking back of lands, followed by intense, very violent military repression from the Mexican government with the use of normal military as well as paramilitary. Then there was a ceasefire in January 11, 1994, and since that ceasefire, there's been a lot of very creative sort of projects to try to find peaceful, civil ways of reaching that goal of national liberation and of local autonomy and of indigenous rights that the Zapatistas have engaged in, which include the establishing of the Caracoles and the Juntas de Buen Gobierno in 2003, and efforts to create sort of like intergalactic or international solidarity around similar values. And all the while, even though these are peaceful projects, there's an emphasis on maintaining a capacity for self-defense. And in the realization that there is always, you know, an imminent threat and oftentimes violent attack on the part of the government. So then can jump up to 2001 maybe and talk a little bit about the March of the Color of the Earth. Basically, the March of the Color of the Earth was on one hand an attempt to engage with the federal government through the legislative body by the Zapatistas. And basically, it was a march to go to Mexico City to do a presentation with, to the legislative body and to advocate for the three demands, basically. Three demands being the release of a long list of political prisoners, the abandoning of seven military stations in Chiapas, and the ratification of the Cocopá law, which was a law for indigenous rights. And on the other hand, the March for the Color of the Earth was also an opportunity for the Zapatistas to engage with civil society. They were stopping in various southern states to meet with organizations and individuals to sort of share and build with them. And in many ways, that aspect of the March of the Color of the Earth can be seen as sort of a precursor to the Otra Campaña, the other campaign that happens more recently. So basically, in a more recent communique called The Pedestrians of History, the Zapatistas reflect on the March of the Color of the Earth and say that it was a failure with respect to engaging with the political party and the political class. Because you know, some political prisoners were released, a few of the army stations were let go, and the Cocopá law was, however, not ratified, and they were actually met with a lot of disrespect from the national government, so it wasn't a success in that point, but that it was a success in trying to build and engage with civil society and these organizations. So, coming out of the March of the Color of the Earth, the Zapatistas sort of realize that that was, again, reinforcing the need to build local autonomy. And why? Because the Mexican government could not be relied upon to provide the kind of services or the kind of reforms and the things that were needed by indigenous people in Mexico, that these things had to be created, again, from below and locally. And also was a realization that Mexico, you know, did not need a vanguardist movement, that Mexico, you know, just as much as they did not need solutions coming from above, coming from the government. So what followed was what was called a period of silence from 2001 to 2005. And a period of silence where the Zapatistas became very introspective and very and focused on their own communities and focused on a lot of initiatives that were based around building local autonomy. Local autonomy in the form of the Juntas de Buen Gobierno, which was a way of, and is a way, of self-governance, participatory democracy, and whatnot, and also autonomy in the idea of being self-sustaining and providing the basic human rights and resources that people need independently from the government. And then, also right after the March of the Color of the Earth, by 2002, the Zapatistas were also starting on a broad outline of what could be the Sixth Declaration. They were very inspired by the conversations that they were having with, you know, civil society during the March of the Color of the Earth, and they wanted to be able to pursue that further. So what was being outlined was a new initiative, civil, peaceful, political initiative, anti-capitalist, with, you know, refusing to engage with the political class again, and also actually putting out a very vocal, critical analysis of the political class. And also sort of figuring out a way to articulate the kind of movement that they wanted to do, which was one that we hear a lot from the left and from below, which is, you know, from the left saying, you know, this analysis against neoliberalism, against capitalism, and from below saying, you know, sort of identifying some of the problems that came out of the March of the Color of the Earth, being that there were privileges that were happening within these dialogues, and that sometimes, you know, people who didn't speak Spanish were not being, you know, having the same way to participate in discussions or whatnot. So really trying to stay attentive to the folks who were still being marginalized in these discussions and whatnot. So coming from the left and from below. So the Sixth Declaration came out, and it was a very important piece of communication because coming after the long silence that had happened. And it also offered a really interesting gift to the world that was sort of like a structure that it adopted that was used by a lot of folks to help identify, to articulate identity, to articulate political analysis, integrate history, integrate theory and practice and vision for this new kind of politics. And that structure was based off of some different chapters, starting with who we are, where we are, how we see the world, how we see our country, which is Mexico, what we want to do, and how we want to do it. And again, this structure has been borrowed by a lot of different folks, including Movimiento para Justicia del Barrio's film that I don't know, I guess was not on the screen here after all, but you know, it's, yeah, oh, okay, cool. So you guys will see that later, you'll see that reflected in there. So then the other campaign, consisted of members of the EZLN, which we can understand as sort of like the military aspect of the Zapatista movement, as well as members of communities, Junta de Buen Gobierno, and all these folks working within what was called the Sixth Commission. The other campaign was originally planned to happen in 4 stages spread across 3 years. So it's not just like a very brief, you know, visit and getting to know people. It's this very long, extended vision of a process. So it consisted of 6 months of exploring and touring, meeting with adherents to the other campaign throughout the country, and followed by reporting back to the adherents of what they had found out about, you know, who all these people were who had decided to be adherents to the other campaign. The next stage was basically to deepen knowledge of each other and to establish a network of communication where adherents could then really support each other and defend each other in their respective struggles. And then after that would be like a presentation and a more defined, solid definition of what the other campaign was, and presenting that to the country, to the world, to the rest of the adherents. And then by 2009, the goal would be that La Otra would have, you know, sort of had a national program of struggle. I don't really know what that means, but, you know, we can maybe, we're not it, so who knows. with this long timeline in mind, so the problems arose, because, you know, we hear about the other campaign, and we hear that it's, you know, this amazing participatory thing that's, you know, prioritizing and emphasizing women's rights, queer rights, indigenous rights, that it's this amazing inclusive thing, but you know what, problems come up, like problems come up with everything. So some of the problems that were identified by the Zapatistas and subsequent communiques were that happened like during some of the early sort of meetings that were happening. A lot of organizations were trying to push for large sweeping decisions to be voted on and made, platforms to be adopted, trying to very early on frame what the discussion was and what the real issue was in Mexico. And the Zapatistas sort of right away said, that's not how we're going to roll. We want the participation of everybody in this movement. And so no decision can be made without engaging first with all of the adherents to the other campaign. Later on, and then it was also identified that there were various adherents to the other campaign that it seemed like were trying to join the other campaign in order to lead it, in order to sort of use it as political capital in the upcoming presidential election, which would be, you know, something that it's definitely not about, seeing as how it very openly separates itself from the political parties and the presidential campaign and all that. And it was also noticed that during a lot of these assemblies, certain organizations that were more accustomed to a process of engaging and participating in assembly and whatnot were being heard more, and that other groups that hadn't had that kind of experience were being marginalized. And so there were all sorts of different, there was also an issue going on with privileging folks who spoke Spanish. Oftentimes, you know, if various indigenous people came into a room and started to speak in their own language, everyone else took that as a cue to go use the restroom, to take a nap or do something, you know. And so it became that Spanish was, proficiency in Spanish language was a privilege that was, you know, marginalizing a lot of folks. There was also an issue that people in urban areas were being privileged over people in rural areas. So folks who had traveled several days to go to an assembly meeting were given the same 3 minutes to present their stuff as people who just hopped on the subway to get to the meeting. And so that was kind of seen as something that wasn't working out so well. And there's various other issues that come up, you know, as usual in these kinds of situations that include, you know, gender and sexuality and all that. All right, so, you know, we can draw like a lot of lessons from the other campaign then to think about how we're doing our stuff here. Another criticism that was happening during the other campaign is, of course, the figure of Marcos. That's very controversial. People were seeing him as like a protagonist figure, and the obvious contradiction that it looks like in what's supposed to be a movement that's an indigenous movement to have a mestizo at the forefront, or as a spokesperson, rather, became an issue. And also Marcos's presence as a military soldier or a military commander made a lot of people uncomfortable because he seemed to represent an institution that functions on hierarchically and vertically and whatnot. And of course, there was also the thing about Atenco that's very complicated. But you know, Atenco happened, and it was sort of a moment of intense government repression against adherence to the other campaign, and was dealt with by the Zapatistas by going on to red alert and pausing the other campaign, and they got a lot of criticism for that. That it would felt like a unilateral decision by one group of adherent to the other campaign, being the Zapatistas, the EZLN. But it was also seen as a good sign that it really was proof that the other campaign was a network that was really going to support its own and wasn't just going to move on to the next state after one group of them had been attacked violently and thrown into jail. So the Zapatistas stuck in Mexico City in order to try to ensure that the political prisoners would be freed there. So I think that there's a lot of things that we can take from Zapatismo, of course. You know, there's the issue of language, how sometimes English language is privileged in these areas and how that sometimes marginalizes folks. I think I'm going to go more into later the positive things that we can draw from that, but first to think a little bit about solidarity and how we use and how we exercise solidarity from out here. And I think, you know, I think coming from a society that's such a huge part of our identity has to do with consumption. I think that one of the first ways that folks exercise their solidarity with Zapatistas or Mexican social movements tends to be to go out and get a book or get a Zapatista doll or something. And so, you know, and that's really important because, like, on one hand, because we have to educate ourselves, we have to read, and, you know, it's good to be able to financially support these groups, you know, and that's something that's very real. But at the same time, I think that that poses another issue that sometimes there's, you know, trying to find a release and almost the danger of almost channeling all of our agency through our, you know, consumption of products that are, in the end, and not really engaging with these struggles in a substantive way. And then there's another thing that is traveling. You know, that's a really fun thing to do, to go down there and interact with these movements. There's a lot of problems that come up, and probably in a discussion we can go into them in more depth. And I think Calamity has a lot of really great ideas to share about solidarity work done through traveling. But basically, you know, trying to be accountable to the places that you're going to, having a plan. I don't know, we can go on, there's a lot. But, and then I think one of the biggest ways that we can be in solidarity with social movements out there is taking what we learned from those social movements and applying them to trying to create social movements here, trying to create autonomy here. And there's all sorts of things that folks have been doing out here. And things that we haven't been doing so much that we can talk about if we're going to talk about some of the post-grad will stuff, that oftentimes is very easy to be very attentive to all the words that are coming out of Oaxaca or Chiapas or DF, and oftentimes very difficult for folks to be attentive to the dialogues and the issues and the circumstances of, you know, perhaps communities of color here in New York City or something like that. And so the issue becomes being accountable to ourselves and to our own communities that we live in. There's been a lot of really great work going on in New York City around that's been inspired by Zapatismo. Estación Libre is a group that I work with that facilitates delegations of people of color to Chiapas to engage with Zapatista communities and try to draw inspiration from that and apply what they learn to the work that they do out here in the States. And Movimiento para Justicia del Barrio, you can find out a lot more about that by reading RJ's excellent article. Accessible on Narco News, but is a group of, for the most part, first-generation Mexican immigrants that are doing tenants' rights organizing in El Barrio East Harlem that draw a lot on Zapatismo and draw on it in ways where, you know, they're trying to build local power from below themselves. They're trying to emphasize on the rights of women and the rights of queer people within their communities, which, as a person that comes from Mexican communities, is something that's very inspirational to see, that I feel like is something that, you know, Mexican communities, that we struggle with a lot and is not very often talked about. Also introducing within our communities a global analysis of neoliberalism that's really, really great. And very physically, the Movimiento just got back from the Encuentro in Juarez and brought back a lot of really interesting things to apply to the work that they do here. Sister to Sister is another great group that has drawn inspiration from the Zapatistas and has been sort of compelled to reevaluate how they are funded, sort of having a critical analysis of the nonprofit industrial complex, as folks are calling it, the idea that, you know, we can really fund and that relying on, you know, these big businesses to fund our projects is not the most sustainable way to go, that we can build infrastructure within our own communities to do our projects, and that maybe professional activism, folks who get paid to do activism, is not always the most sustainable thing either, that perhaps we should think about you know, revolution in everyday life and you know, all these other things. Okay, and then Child Care Collective, emphasizing, you know, youth and children and families and our movements, trying to have an open process that engages a lot of people and is not hierarchical. A lot of people are very excited about the U.S. Social Forum that's coming up. I'm sure you can talk to Arjun more about that later, but folks are seeing that might be a possibility, a possible venue to have something similar to what the other campaign was up here in the U.S. And you know, there's tons of stuff going on, so maybe we can talk about that in a more open discussion.
Cool. All right, so before we go into discussion though, the group that Connect touched upon, Movement for Justice in El Barrio, wanted to be here tonight, but couldn't. And so what they have sent is they've sent a message for us, and we're also going to screen, I think, some of the film that they originally created to bring down with them to the border meetings with Subcomandante Marcos and the Sixth Commission for the other campaign. So I think first, I guess I'll read this message that they sent for us. Okay. Renee's suggesting we do the video after the discussion. Yes? Yeah? Okay. Alright. Yeah, that's good. Let's do it. Alright, so
Yo, can someone get me and Connect some water? Por favor.
Alright. To Left Turn Magazine and those present from Movement for Justice in El Barrio, members of the other campaign in New York City. We appreciate the invitation to be a part of this gathering. We would like to take this opportunity to express the sadness and pain we feel knowing that our compañero Brad Will was killed while fulfilling his duty. While in Oaxaca, in his own way, he was doing his part to create a new world. Those who die fighting for a new world do not die in vain. We appreciate being given the space to explain what we put our time and efforts into. It is our priority to maintain and expand our community base, which is our membership, simple and humble people who decide where we are headed and what steps we take to advance. We are fighting and will continue fighting against gentrification and for dignified housing in El Barrio until we eradicate this problem. We are preparing ourselves to initiate our new campaign regarding the next issue we will be tackling. We wish to kick this campaign off during the first few months of 2007. We are also deeply involved in how the other campaign moves forward. We are preparing a series of public forums where we will convene those good, humble, and simple hearts that have yet to learn that they too have a place in the grandest dream of all. In the dream that in a new dawning, we will make reality. The dream called the Sixth Declaration of the Lacandon Jungle. We are sorry we cannot be with you tonight. We believe you will understand that the work we do is not little. The members that form part of our leadership team are all volunteers. We work 10 to 12 hours daily, and we can only organize in the little time we have left. But we would like to meet with you. We promise that soon we will meet with you to continue building the new world that we dream of. For now, thanks for listening to our words through the video we screened to the Zapatista delegation at the Encuentro with Immigrants held recently in Juarez, Mexico. Thank you, Movement for Justice Navarro. So why don't we go on Renee's suggestion and maybe kind of start a discussion. I'll try to moderate. I'll try to keep some gender parity as well. So, you know, but I'm calling you right away. Maybe that's why.
Just before we get started with the discussion, my name is Andy Cornell. I've started working with Left Turn in the last few months since this summer. I want to thank everyone for coming. Since this is kind of an issue release event for the new Left Turn magazine, I wanted to say a couple words about it and encourage people to check it out in the hall. There's a table with the magazine, some t-shirts that are a fundraiser for the magazine, and a couple other things like some videos. But as most people here know, Left Turn Magazine is a quarterly publication that's completely volunteer run, and it's created by an editorial collective that's kind of dispersed across the country, some folks here in New York, New Orleans, the Bay Area, etc. And it's also distributed by a larger grouping or collective, group of collectives that try and get the magazine out in events like this, through mailings, through info shops, progressive newsstands and bookstores, but also directly to activist organizations and communities. So some folks might know that the kind of left press has been going through some difficult times lately. Unfortunately, some magazines, periodicals that Left Turn has collaborated with, such as Clamor Magazine or Lit Magazine, have gone out of publication just in the last couple of months. We want to make sure that Left Turn kind of is kind of broadening and building its subscriber base, and so it doesn't kind of succumb to a lot of the economic pressures that unfortunately have taken some of these other important periodicals out of commission. So we're doing a lot of things. One of the other things that we've started recently is trying to offer free subscriptions to any prisoner that is interested in the magazine, getting the information out. But of course, that adds to kind of the economics of it as well. So just wanted to say that, put that out about the magazine. People are interested in finding out more about it, please come talk to us afterwards. And please do pick up the new issue. It's $4. There's back issues for a couple bucks. And consider getting a subscription, buying a t-shirt or a video, and you can think of it as a holiday present to have people you need to give gifts to. All right, thanks, Bill. Good to see you on that.
Other questions?
Just leave me this thought.
Well, I guess the first thing that occurs to me is it seems that, you know, like you say, we've been doing these Mexico things now for the last couple of months, and we've had a bunch of them, and we've had these discussions sort of about what solidarity means. And Calamity's point at the end of her presentation about sort of the parallels between Nicaragua and now, and sort of what the difference is in how we think about our solidarity movement. You know, in the 70s, at that point, when a U.S. journalist was killed, he was very much within a sort of a mainstream journalism and very much sort of recognizable as a journalist, right, within the mainstream. And there was also this idea, this sort of target, that we could say our government is doing these things in this place, right? And so while all of us here obviously sort of understand the complicity of our government in the system that is creating this repression within Mexico, and I do think that a sort of national perspective is necessary, that we have a tendency to compartmentalize and say, this is what's happening in Oaxaca, this is what's happening with the Zapatistas, this is what's happening with the PRD, this is what's happening in Juarez, that we don't have this idea, or we can't mobilize sort of beyond this community, this idea that our government is complicit in this, or that we as sort of participants in our government are complicit in this kind of repression. So I'm wondering, when we talk about sort of new forms of solidarity and new ways of thinking about what we're doing and the sort of inherent latent racism that goes on with the sort of across the Rio Grande divide, what we can do when we're not saying, when we can't make the sort of broader case that our government is complicit, right? Because that's what mobilized people in the 80s. That's what mobilized the Central America Solidarity Movement, was saying our government is explicitly involved in this. They're paying these people, they're training these people, they're doing these things. And that's why US citizens are mobilized. So what do we do when we say now, you know, our capitalist system, the capitalist system that we, that our government perpetuates, the, this model that we've created and exported, and that the PAN and the PRI and the PRD are all part of institutionalizing in Mexico? I guess that's like, you know, that's sort of the next step in sort of figuring out what this new solidarity means.
So why don't we take like a few thoughts, and I mean, other people should feel free to respond also to what people are bringing up. So take a few more. Like collect a few.
Are we taking like a stack of questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
in response to what you just said, one way they could be a direct connection is if any of the PFD officers are graduates of the School of the Americas, which is plausible, but I don't know. I don't know if that's the case.
Some research that could be
done. SOA Watch is actually researching that, and who's been in the Oaxaca conflict, who was trained at the School of Americas. And if they don't have something on their website now about it, then they will soon.
Cool.
And then I wanted to ask you, you talked about ungovernability,
mm-hmm.
and that was a slogan and a strategy of the African National Congress and the United Democratic Front in South Africa in the 1980s. Is that just a coincidence that comes up here, or is the AP
Like I said before, you know, like Oaxaca isn't, you know, it's not intellectuals. I think, like, you know, a lot of people in the movement in Oaxaca can't read. You're not talking about people who are like educated on, you know, the history of global resistance because they've gone to like some fancy, you know, quasi leftist college in the States or something. So I think it's a coincidence.
Ungovernability specifically in Oaxaca is a strategy, and it has something to do with the constitution of Oaxaca, which is that if they can figure out, if the federal government decides that that Oaxaca is ungovernable, that the government there is incapable of governing, then the federal government has the power to take all powers away from the state government. So the idea was they're working within the framework of their constitution, which is kind of so many movements do this, right? It's like you work within the framework of the constitution, it's legal, right? And the idea was to prove that they're ungovernable, that the state is ungovernable, have all those powers removed legally, and have the OPPO be there as sort of a mechanism that is already generating those other forms of governance. Well, what actually happened was the federal government refused to recognize that ungovernability and everything that came after it, as Calamity mentioned.
In November, the government was recognizing the ungovernability. I mean, it was, you know, the Secretary of State was talking about the problem of ungovernability and what happened.
Okay, because...
Well, and also the issue of ungovernability was just huge in the media. That's, like, the only way that it's been covered here and in the major national...
But, you know, on the streets, it kind of felt like, you know... I mean, it's not only Ulises. This is something that, like, I didn't really get a chance to talk about. Ulises is kind of, like, the central demand underneath, like, all these people that are working for different things, like migrant rights and working over land disputes, and working for different things that are really stemming from neoliberalism. And so Ulises Ruiz and him coming out of power was kind of like the central demand that kind of like, you know, pasted together all these other things that people were working around, because he was the one who was like putting forth, all this repression to make a, so that neoliberalism could be, you know, steadily applied. Like always, like it comes with neoliberal policies, comes with, militant government repressive force, right? But, you know, the ungovernability was also like really symbolic. It was kind of like this feeling in the streets, like I said, where, it was this way of not recognizing the authority and not recognizing the government and saying, you know, like the government isn't from the people, and therefore we can't be governed by this government because they're not us. And it's not, you know, a political mandate that's coming from below or coming from the people themselves. And so ungovernability was like what, you know, yeah, it was definitely like a legal strategy, but it was also, it was just kind of this natural thing that came out of the energy from the streets in Oaxaca, I feel like.
Yeah. When the Senate initially addressed it, they said that Ulises and his crew ran around and produced enough papers and enough documents to have the initial reading say that, yes, it was governable. Mm-hmm. And then later there were disputes within the two levels of the Senate about some levels of the Senate wanting to get rid of the powers and some decided not to. And the point that's been made about the pre and bottom lines, I think, is key to understanding.
But, I mean, I think, like, the people in Oaxaca didn't care whether or not, I mean, maybe, like, strategically, legally, they cared about if it was going to be declared ungovernable or not, you know, but like what the government is up to in the streets, they weren't governable.
And that's why in the shells of these old institutions and this old authority, you know, they were governing themselves and directing their own lives. They are, actually.
I just want to respond to the point that, or the question, or the big challenge that you raised. I'm often very optimistic, but I'm also, I tend to be, I don't know, pessimistic is the right word, but I think the question about solidarity goes beyond the message that we're sending. It's much more complex than how can we get people to identify or to understand this problem, because if they get it, then they will become active. I mean, everyone in this country knows and is opposed to the fact that the U.S. government is conducting an imperialist war in Iraq. Right, that intervention is clear to everyone. Yet there's no anti-war movement, which would be like the solidarity toward the people of Iraq. Right. The second thing is the 80s solidarity movements were kind of it was an easier puzzle. I mean, you had the Frente Sandinista. All right, they had three tendencies, whatever, but it was one frente with that followed one strategy. So here, the solidarity reflected that strategy. Similarly, in El Salvador, in the final offensive in 89, solidarity here was supporting that. You know, it was very easy to find out what we had to do because they had a more monolithic kind of approach to the struggle back then, making our tasks easier. The other thing that happened, I think, in the 80s, it's like the remnants of a real left movement that existed here was still around, and it was
they weren't tenured.
Well, they hadn't, folded into the Democratic Party, but there was still something there, and solidarity with Central American Revolution became, where we could channel our efforts. I think I'm not that old to have experienced that. But so we have to think about the real constraints we're facing when we think about solidarity. The first major one is that, mass mobilization, direct action, for some reason, is not really appealing to people in this country right now. I don't know if it's because we think it doesn't work or because we're dumb. I don't think that's the answer, right? But there's something that's holding that back. We have to figure out what it is. The second thing is the very nature of the movements we're trying to be solidarity with in Mexico, in other countries, present a real tough challenge. I mean, we all want to see the movement advance in Mexico, but as you said, there's the Zapatistas, the Otra Campaña, which incidentally I think took way too long to get involved in solidarity with the Apple. So if they're not, if those questions aren't worked out there, how are we supposed to work them out? It's really tough. I don't know what the answers are, but one basic thing is, well, we have to rebuild a movement here with our own logic, our own dynamic, our own goals. That's a big challenge.
I was going to go connect, and then I was actually going to jump to Liz and then Max, kind of keep some of the flow going, get different voices in.
I had a few thoughts about what it sounded like you were talking about the importance of trying to make clear the connection between our own government's role in what's happening in repression in Mexico. And I think some problems come up. I think that the tactic of trying to hold our own government accountable for what's going on in Latin America right now is oftentimes very easy to backfire, I think, and some of that is seen, I think, in the post-Bradwell's death. There was this, a lot of times a tendency to say, the U.S. government, you're in many ways responsible for this, so you need to do something about it, and in many ways what we were saying, is you need to leave. But it was very easy for the U.S. government to say, you're right, we need to fix it, so let's send in the FBI and do an investigation. And that's really not what we wanted to do, but it's very easy for the U.S. government to say, we need to be accountable, let's be accountable, our style and under our rules and the way we're going to do it. And then that takes, our agency away. And so it's I think, really tricky like that. And then I think that Renee brought up a really good point that, as far as the effectiveness of pointing out the clear connection between the U.S.'s economic policies and foreign policies, in Mexico, the connection is really clear to the destruction of Iraq, and yet we haven't been able to hold our government accountable for that. So, you know, is the solution really to hold our government accountable? Is our government something right now that we can hold accountable? Or is our solution in strengthening our networks between our own grassroots movements here and those in Oaxaca, and doing that in a really, you know, positive and thoughtful and effective way? And then also, like Renee said, strengthening our social movements here and really identifying and making clear the subversive effect of local autonomy. You know, right now, Oaxaca is feeling intense repression. Why? Because they exercised their local autonomy. You know, they didn't go and take over Mexico City and then, you know, the federal government retaliated against them. They said, no, we here are free. And so that's a really, really, really effective way to give a big hit to the system, is to assert yourself and say, we're going to provide our own things. We're going to make our own decisions about how we govern, how we organize our communities and things like that. So, you know, and that's the kind of things that the Zapatistas are always saying. The best way to support us is to make sure that you get free too.
Maybe get a few more questions, and then we'll go to statements and go to other responses.
Yeah, I was just going to respond a bit to the question that Mr. Solomayor's prayer. It struck, I'm like a veteran of those 70s, 80s solidarity movements, and so it is so different in a lot of ways. But one thing that really strikes me, looking at the movements, particularly in Latin America and Mexico and Bolivia, is that whether they're intellectuals or educated or literate, people know that it's neoliberalism and what neoliberalism is, that it's polarizing, that it's increasing unemployment, poverty, but they know that that education has been done by the left. I mean, the Zapatistas started with the beginning of NAFTA. They've raised it, you know, and it's been raised in Sao Paulo forums, lots of stuff, so that it's somehow it's internalized in a way that we haven't even begun to in this country. I mean, and that's, I mean, that is the link to our government. This is an economic oppression, not a paramilitary at the same time. And they know it, you know. And like in the statement from the group in El Barrio, they said something about training around neoliberalism in the statement department. I hadn't heard that being said in non-community level groups, but it does strike me that that's kind of very interesting now for us, and it should be part of how we strategize what it is. I mean, we can't even use the word. People say it's too big, you know, in the general discourse.
Thanks. It was touched on a little bit, but I was wondering if someone could, I know Renee has spoken on this before, but the mass kind of migrant workers movements that sprang up here in the U.S. in the spring has really the kind of the logical and obvious manifestation here in the U.S. of a mass movement that has a real mass quality, I think, unlike the anti-war movement, which is expressing mass sentiment but doesn't have that mass base necessarily in that same way. I was wondering maybe if someone could touch on the ways that movements here in the U.S. that are seeking on the surface simply to extend the franchise to win some basic reforms, as the civil rights movement, the early stages of the Black Freedom Movement did, but still actually have the imagination and the capacity to be transformed into real revolutionary and mass-based movements, and the way that radicals like interact with those movements, oftentimes very standoffish, because it's like, oh no, this is like reformist, like, you know, we see like the March Today, Vote Tomorrow slogan, it's like, you know, this stuff is horrible, but really actually like looking at what these mass movements are moving towards, and how we can interact with those resistance.
I got Ms. Sway on stack, but I know Sandy.
I wanted to respond to what she said earlier. I don't know if I can. Can I?
Sure.
Oh, okay. I think it's really interesting how you started out talking, I mean, how you were responding to something that was said about what happened after Brad died. and how you bring it into, oh, but like the reason people responded in Nicaragua wasn't only because the journalist died, but because the U.S. Government was involved. And like, you know, this like pathology of self-interest is something that's really interesting to me, because I, you know, I think all governments are bad. I don't understand why people in the U.S. and I've traveled all around the world, and I see it here more than anywhere else, have to have something that they can relate to, that's like close to home to them in you know, their own psychological sense, for them to be able to do anything. And I think that you see it right now more than ever with Brad's death. And you know, people are reacting, you know, to Brad's death, even though Brad's death, you know, justified and accelerated and motivated, not motivated, but was, you know, enabled the Federal Preventive Police to go into Oaxaca, which was something I forgot to mention, that Brad's death was used that way. It's a double-edged sword, that death. And that, you know, looking at Brad's death, there was also all these journalists in Oaxaca who were really like looking to like make a name off of it, you know, come out with these really good investigations and stuff like this. And like, there's a big problem of solidarity is based around self-interest. And so if we're always reacting to what the U.S. government is doing, or we're always reacting to somebody, you know, who feels close to us somehow, whether it's because we're in an indie media network, or because, you know, they're from the same town as us, or because they're, you know, our best friend and our lover, are dying, then like really we're like perpetuating that same cycle. And that's what I'm really, really worried about. You know, a lot of people ask me, like, you know, on the radio and stuff like this, after I went into Oaxaca, but like, you know, after the death of Brad Will and stuff like this, who was someone that you knew, who was someone you might have worked with down there, you know, why did you decide to go, but you know, to go in anyway? And it's like, well, you know, Brad Will didn't affect my decision at all. And so like really kind of like reversing that type of psychology and addressing it every type of time it comes up, I think is really important.
So we're like 20 till 10, and to like, you know, respect folks' energies and stuff, and also maybe to even give folks a chance to look at some of the pictures in the back. We got books that actually that are a fundraiser for Movement for Justice in El Barrio, so when you buy those books, all the money's going back to that group. And then, of course, there's a left turntable out there. We want to give folks some time to do that. Plus, we still got a little bit of this video to show. So I'm wondering if maybe Josue and Jacob, say what you want to say. We'll close the stack there. Maybe if there somebody has maybe some brief last things they want to say, do the little video thing and, you know, wrap it up before we like totally just lose ourselves one by one.
Or I can say something totally provocative in the conversation for something honest. I wanted to actually bring up the how we talk about the other. There was want to challenge us around language, and I understand the desire to point out the not being traditional leftists or book leftists or intellectuals, and at the same time it resonates a particular kind of difference that has some sort of hierarchy. And really challenge us to practice doing that. The first time I heard the expression the surplus value of labor, realized that the group of janitors that I was organizing were breaking it fucking down, right? Their life experience was so much more politically developed than any analysis or reading that I had done, and so the really learning how to, and then it's not even value. It's understand that certainly from a political level, Latin America, the Latinos, the struggles that they've been going through, just from living, has created so much more of a deeper level of sophistication in thinking about these things. And so just wanna challenge us to
just leave it there. On that note of language, one question I had was whether this phrase that kind of goes across each of your stories,
and each of your particular tales of resistance and rebellion was this phrase, revolution from below. And I was wondering whether in each of your mouths that phrase means something different, and whether that below is a totally different category, whether it's from these models of government that you talked about, where people, you know, are dealing with the crisis, or whether it's this ungovernability in the streets that's the below, or the Zapatista model, which is in between kind of the macro and this micro crisis. What, how do we kind of, which below are we, you understand? Or which below are we looking towards? And also the revolution part of that. I mean, they all seem like different strategies, but, you know, revolution is not just the resistance, but it's usually a founding. So I'm just wondering what that founding would be. And we don't have the time to answer this question, but maybe in the future.
So as our presenters are formulating their final 1 minute thoughts. I also wanted to draw folks to some upcoming things going on in the city, which is that tomorrow is actually the first New York City-wide meeting in solidarity with Oaxaca. So hopefully this will be a space for people to think more strategically, to bring up these critiques and also bring up our hopes for the sort of work that we can build in the city. Sunday from 2 p.m. to midnight is a Oaxaca Solidarity Benefit in El Barrio at the Julio de Burgos Cultural Arts Center. Try to come out to this. The people that are organizing this fundraiser are building a really interesting solidarity project in Oaxaca, which they'll talk more about.
Is the electronics donation thing happening there?
Yes. Yeah, so part of that is gathering media equipment to then work with groups in rural Oaxaca who are going to be establishing their own sort of media communication networks. And then December 22nd has been called for a global day of action in solidarity with Oaxaca. The Zapatistas called this day. I think it's especially touching because this is usually the day that the massacre of Acteal, which is a massacre against not even the Zapatistas, but communities in Chiapas happened. And so it's kind of particularly touching that they've chosen that day to call for this for this global day of action. And then these are some websites. I would say the best in terms of Oaxaca specifically is El Enemigo Común. It's updated many times every day. Simone, who now lives in New York City, kind of does that. And then there's narconews.com, which does a lot of reporting about different movements throughout Mexico and Latin America. And then I already plugged my blog, so there's that.
Oh, you forgot. There's also indie media. You know, there's been times when indie media was the only stuff coming out. And also Counterpunch has had some people writing from there.
So we have people writing from there. We have these flyers. We're having Carlos Montiwes and Rosana Reguillo, who are two of the most important sort of thinkers in Mexico, cultural critics in Mexico. We're actually very lucky that they're flying to New York to talk to us about sort of the nationwide crisis in Mexico. That's going to happen on February 1st. We don't have a space yet, but it's going to happen at NYU somewhere.
So that's what these sites are. Final thoughts, people prepping the video.
We have some stuff about women.
I'm sorry, what's your name? Jacob. I think the question that you made is the question. Maybe not for us, but certainly for the left in Latin America right now. To begin with, when I think of struggle from below, the very basic thing for me, above all else, is that it's real material struggle that have to do with people's daily lives. That's what I think of from below. So an idea, a sense that you can mobilize people in a way that's not around their real issues in an everyday life, I'm skeptical of. Beyond that, I think the question has to do with the state. Right now, there's a big tendency in Latin America to try to put forth an alternative that says, no, we don't have to engage, much less seize state power. We can kind of make the revolution independent of that. I think that the revolution has to be made from below. In other words, it has to be people building a movement autonomously, democratically, horizontally, but it has to come up with a strategy of confronting state power. I think what we're up against is way too strong to think that we don't need to do it. The state, especially the neoliberal state, is so destructive. Its forces against people are so huge and devastating that the very nature, I mean, the very existence of the planet is at stake. So if we say the revolution from below means that we're just kind of building our movement and we don't need to take state power, I think we're surrendering basically the fate of humanity. I mean, it sounds dramatic and stuff, but and I tend not to use hyperbole, but I mean, that's what we're up against. So we need to come up with a way of bringing in all the lessons this, you know, Zapatismo has given us, you know, Mandaro de Siendo, etc. But we need to put it together in a way that eventually lets people, you know, control these levers and reorganize society in a way that actually benefits humanity and not vice versa. If not, I mean, the prospects are pretty good.
So remember, this is your 1 minute final thought. This is your emotional reaction to what was just said.
Okay. I mean, from you know, the Zapatistas and from Oaxaca, I'm not really sure what you were saying, but I think that you know, the revolution from below has nothing to do with taking power, because they're people who have had you know, people handing down orders from them and you know, repression and directing their lives and directing their fates and using neoliberal policies to ruin their economy and make them miserable, you know, for decades and 500 years in Mexico. And so I think that the revolution from below has to do with organizing horizontally, has to do with consensus-based organizing, has to do with not hesitating, not thinking twice, and that it doesn't really have to do with taking state power and taking power over others, because it's exactly what they're fighting. And it's a really important lesson in Latin America, and it's the most exciting thing, is that all these things are going on and nobody is taking power. And there's no, you know, there's not one group, you know, who's in power. It kind of stays below. It stays, you know, from the housewives to the farmers to the students to the homeless punks, you know, and it stays on like that surface, and there is no fight to get up to, you know, some level of power. And this, like, you know, what is it? Mandar de, o sea, mandar obedeciendo y obedecir mandando.
Yeah.
¿Cómo es?
Mandar obedeciendo.
Uh-huh. So, ¿cómo es en inglés?
Oh, to lead by obeying.
Uh-huh. This, like, lead by obeying thing is as close as anyone gets to power, to taking any power. And so, and you know, it's all direct, community-based direct democracy and community and collective organizing. And yeah, I think that is what revolution from below is autonomous, direct democracy, horizontal, non-hierarchical organizing. Yes.
I think it's a really great question. And I think that the statement from below is one of those sort of metaphors that can be used in a lot of ways. That's able to be put out there and can be applied to do a lot of really important introspection. And the first thing that it hit me when I read the phrase or heard the phrase or whatever had to do with the idea that I thought was, you know, resonated with me a lot, that, you know, revolution and freedom can happen without taking state power. So that was the first very thought that came to my mind when I used to hear that word. And but then, of course, it's also from below is sort of difficult because it can very easily get a little bit offensive, because it kind of suggests that there's people below us and that maybe we're on top, or maybe we're below and someone else is on top. And I guess if we think about from below and think of ourselves as coming from below, then that would have more to do with not looking down and trying to, like, ask the people who are below us what to do, but maybe looking to our sides and sort of being horizontal, like Calamity was talking about. But then something else that comes to mind for me with the idea of from below is a process that should happen continuously that has to do with always trying to check ourselves when we're looking for something high, or something really important, something really powerful happening, you know, up there, or something to admire, and then very easily get distracted from the silences and from the folks who, you know, didn't have the language confidence to speak up at that meeting, or the folks who had to stay home with the kids, or, you know, the kids who had to stay home with the moms. You know, like, so it basically, to me, from below means always being attentive to the folks who weren't in the spotlight and who aren't occupying the spotlight, and constantly trying to check ourselves on how we marginalize the people who love and the people who are in our communities and things like that. So, I think it can be used for a lot of things.
So let's thank our three presenters.